Hey everyone, it's Jen. First of all, I wanted to say thank you to each and every one of you. I was invited onto Vanished almost a year ago now. When Chris first contacted me, I knew absolutely nothing about Amelia Earhart, but I agreed to an interview and then I agreed to stick around. I learned a lot in the process of researching for the show, and I've grown a lot as well. And throughout this whole thing, you guys have been incredibly welcoming, helpful, and supportive. I really enjoyed getting to meet all of you on social media and getting to personally chat with those of you who agreed to come onto the show. I conducted a lot of interviews over the past several months, but after our final closing arguments, there was one person left who I was just dying to chat with on the record, and that's the director of the Chasing Earhart project himself, Chris Williamson. This interview took place on September 28th, 2019. I hope you all enjoy this epilogue to the first season of Vanished as much as I enjoyed recording it.
No, I'm ready. So yeah, you let me know whenever you're ready to go. And I'm ready to answer whatever you throw at me.
Okay. Well, I know you've told like the origin story before in other places about like how you got involved in Amelia Earhart stuff. So just tell it again, because I don't think you ever said it on Vanished or Chasing Earhart. You've said it on other people's shows, but you've never told your listeners.
Yeah, probably not. So it's been a long time for me, really. I got involved unofficially when I was in third grade. I remember just doing this paper on her, this project on her that we were asked to do. And there was a teacher I had in third grade that had put all these 8x10s around the room of all these famous Americans. And you had anybody that you can think of that's a famous American, just pick a name. They were probably on the wall. And Earhart was on the wall. Nobody really knew who she was at that time, at least in my class. So it was the famous bomber jacket with her hands on her hips. If you Google her right now, you'll see it. And it was just one of those pictures that sort of called to me. So I ended up picking her after a couple of days of no one else picking her. And I did a History Day project on her, like a paper/project type deal. And I remember just not wanting it to finish. I wanted to keep going because I was so fascinated by this woman's life and what she stood for. Even at that age, I was just really sort of in the mystery of self. Even then, I sort of like, well, what happened? Why couldn't we find her? Why has she not been found at that point? So I just kept going, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. It just kept going and going and going until I started getting into high school and writing more complex papers, and the ideas became more complex and all that good stuff. So it always stayed with me. And oddly enough, it's sort of when I met my wife and sort of went away for a little while because we had other priorities and other things going on. But back in, I want to say it was probably 09, I started officially doing pre-research, 08, 09, something like that, and on a project that I had no idea the title of or the structure or anything like that. I just knew I wanted to do an Earhart project, and it ended up being Chasing Earhart all these years later. It took us years to figure out a name, a title, a logo, all that good stuff. And so I got into this really sort of as just a fan of her legacy, and you know, it's not really unlike so many other people that have, and it just sort of turned into this big thing. I remember having a guest list of the original 25 people I wanted on that list. And I remember reaching out to those people, and every one of those 25 people said, yes, they'll do an interview, they'll do the show, podcast, whatever we were doing at the time. And so that list just started to grow and grow and grow. And it just became, I think it now sits at somewhere around 270 people. We've talked to almost anybody who's anybody in the Earhart community. There's a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, we've talked to everyone. And we've talked to a lot of people that are not in the Earhart community, people that you would never normally hear or see on a podcast or in a documentary. We've either shot with them for the show or had them as a guest in the podcast. So that's how I got into it. It just sort of fell into my lap when I was a kid and got introduced to her like so many other kids at that time. And just never stopped, as you know, more probably better than anybody.
How old were you when the Unsolved Mysteries thing came out?
I wasn't born yet. You're talking about the Leonard Nimoy special, right?
No, the Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, the Robert Unsolved Stack. Mysteries. Oh, Robert Stack. You know, I don't remember what year that came out, but I remember I was a kid. I was pretty young. I was probably, I think that came out in, didn't that come out in like an 85 or 86 or something like that?
Oh, I don't know, because I actually was not born yet. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that. Yeah, no, I was it was I was probably pretty young. I remember watching Unsolved Mysteries and Robert Stack later. I didn't obviously had heard about it. And of course the Leonard Nimoy In Search Of episode that everybody credits for introducing them to Earhart. I saw that much later in life too. So yeah, those two recordings are pretty big in Earhart research, those two shows.
Yeah, did that influence you any, or was it just like the school academic stuff?
I was already there, I think, for the most part, when those came out. I think it just fueled fire. That's probably the best way to look at those shows. When they come out and you see all these larger than life, at the time, larger than life researchers in my eyes. You see Elgin Long and Fred Gerner and Joe Jervis and all these people on the In Search Of piece. And then you see the Unsolved Mysteries and you see that research continue. And it just sort of was a fire fueler for me. It just sort of kind of, as I watched them, I was older, so I had done several years of projects on Earhart, and I was already fascinated. I was already hooked in the case. I mean, there was no going back for me at that point anyway. But yeah, watching stuff like that, definitely it gets you more fired up. It gets you more excited because anytime you see anything like that, you see people actually searching for someone that you want to find out what happened to. It definitely gets you going.
So at what point did you decide to go from I'm just going to learn everything I can about it to I actually want to produce a show or a documentary, a podcast, or whatever it is you were thinking about actually doing and putting out there? When did you make that transition?
Probably 2012, 2013, something like that. Early in 08, 09, I knew I wanted to do something, but I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I remember sort of just trying to figure out, well, what's the best way to tackle this? What's the best way to do sort of this potential show that I wanted to do? And I remember, like, in 2012, podcasting had become really big at the time. It had kind of blown up, so to speak. Not as big as it is now, of course, but it had really started to sort of blow up. And I remember watching, or I'm sorry, I remember listening to Astonishing Legends at that time when they came out in 2014, I think was their first episode. It was like their fourth and fifth episode of their show. So it was really, really early in their run. And I remember just before that, I had decided on podcast, but I didn't have any sort of representation of what the podcast should sound like, what should it feel like, all that. Should it be a long form interview show? Should it be just me and perhaps maybe somebody else just kind of chit chatting back and forth and just maybe have a guest on every once in a while? I wasn't really sure. And then I heard their show, their two part piece, and it was just so organic and it was just so nicely done and so professional, and just, of course, still deny that now, but it was so good. And it's sort of what you come to expect from Astonishing Legends quality-wise and with their research. And so that's when I sort of decided, okay, podcast for sure. I thought for practical reasons, it would be the best bet because I wouldn't have to actually physically go to anybody. We can just do it over the internet. We could do it via Zoom, how we've done every show. And I could just reach out to these people. I could have people from all over the world on the show pretty easily and just coordinate with them via email and just reach out to them, tell them what we're doing, see if they want to come on the show, give us their viewpoints. And that was pretty much how we decided, okay, it was going to be a podcast. Documentary was never something I wanted to do. I never wanted to do a documentary. I wasn't in my realm. I didn't feel comfortable doing that. But I actually fell into some folks that actually knew how to do documentaries and were documentarians that actually pushed for me and said, you really should do this. And I had the idea, I had a vision, but I didn't have the means to sort of go about making that vision happen until right after we decided to do the podcast, actually. So it sort of all happened one, two, three. Decided on a podcast, heard Astonishing Legends. So I knew, okay, that's for sure what I want to do. That's sort of the format I wanted it to take. And then we had the documentary hit almost simultaneously right there. And we started shooting for the documentary at the same time we started recording for the podcast. So we double book guests for different things. And that's just kind of how it all came together.
So at some point, you're talking to all these different people. I imagine at some point, pretty early on, you realized that not all of these people get along with each other. Right?
Yeah, that's apparent, right off the
How
bat.
did
If
Yeah, how did that come about? What how was that?
if you do any research, even badly, right off the bat that there are multiple theories, there's multiple camps. A lot of these people don't get along on a personal basis, even. There's a lot of there's a lot of anger and bitterness in this investigation on a lot of different aspects, but there's also a lot of wonderful, wonderful people involved in the investigation too, in various aspects, theories and things. So pretty early on, we knew right away there was going to be conflict. And I remember when we did the first couple of shows, the way we did it is we sort of just gathered a bunch of contact information for a lot of different folks. And we reached out to everybody within probably a 48-hour period. And we said who we were. I even have the original emails, you know, when I sent all these people out on our original email address, explained who we are, what we're doing, you know, why this is different and what we're trying to attempt here with this podcast and with this show and all that. And I remember what was really interesting is we didn't really hear from anybody other than Dr. Tom King and Rick Gillespie. We heard from those two almost right off the bat. I was really rather surprised when Rick Gillespie actually returned my email and then picked up the phone and actually had a conversation with me. I thought that was very kind of him to do that, because as far as he was concerned, I'm a nobody, and I was. And he picked up the phone, had a 45-minute conversation with me, talked about the Earhart case, always told me he enjoys talking about it. And Dr. Tom King was very gracious. This is a guy that our viewers or our listeners are very well familiar with at this point. He's written multiple books. He's a staple in the Earhart investigation, and he's also very humble about it, doesn't take himself too seriously. Both of those guys agreed to record. So I recorded the inaugural episode, which sounds terrible if we listen to it now, but it's out there, of Chasing Earhart, and it was with Dr. King. And it was episode 1. We recorded that. And the next day, I recorded episode 3, which was a little over 2-hour conversation with Rick Gillespie. It was the first time he'd given an interview that long and that in-depth. And I put out episode 1, which was King. Episode 2, which was a really nice gentleman by the name of Paul Niquette, who has a website called Which Way Emilio, he applies mathematics to the world of flight, and it's really fascinating. And then episode 3, I put out Rick Gillespie. And at that time, we were doing it bi-weekly. And I cannot tell you, after the Gillespie interview, how much absolute hate mail we got. Probably into the dozens and dozens and dozens of email messages from people all over the place talking about how we were a mole for Tiger, we were in bed with Tiger, and you know, we claim that we're doing this big Earhart piece, but the first two out of three episodes are Tiger interviews and all this stuff, other stuff. And what they didn't really realize at the time was I had interviewed, I think, 8 or 10 other folks at that point. We just didn't have the time to put it out yet. We were waiting to put stuff out. So we had to sort of put out fires immediately when it came to the different camps and the different people that disagree with each other. And so we were sort of, in the beginning, made out to be sort of an association with Tiger. And that couldn't have been further from the truth, as you well know now. But it's just one of those situations where you don't get a chance to put out all your stuff yet. So we experienced it right away. I mean, almost immediately, episode 1 on the show, we got hate mail. We got people that just did not like the show, did not like that we featured, you know, King as our first guest, didn't like that we picked that theory first. We should have picked this theory or that theory. And it has only gotten worse, and it has never stopped. The only difference now is my attitude towards it is very, very different than it was over three years ago when we first started this.
Why do you think that is? Like, where do you think that comes from? Because I get it. I've been on Reddit. I know how people can be about things. But what has always, from the very beginning, from the very first day that you and I had a conversation about it back in February, when you first contacted me, I have always just been baffled about how upset people get over this case. And I understand being fascinated with it. I understand caring about it. But it's, at the end of the day, it's a historical story. It's, you know, none of these people have any kind of personal interest in what happened to her, other than just caring about it and wanting to know. Like, you know, I mean, it just, where do you think that this comes from? Why are people so upset that they have to send an email and have to, you know, like, start blocking you on social media? Like, how does that happen?
I think it's really just comes down to the need to be right. And it's one of those situations where everybody is so invested in this investigation. They really are. It's not, dare I say, it's not a historical mystery. It's the historical mystery. I really believe, and we've talked about this so much on the show, you and I, that this is a case that it's very different than a lot of the other major historical cases because we just don't know. We don't have any idea what happened to these two people. And it's my opinion now, a lot of people would disagree with the statement I'm about to make, but it's my opinion now that we're no closer now to knowing what happened to them than we were on July the 3rd, 1937, the day after they disappeared. So I feel like there's more evidence now, possibly. There's certainly more theory, there's certainly more story, but what is there that's concrete, that's really hardcore, that's out there now wasn't out there the day after they disappeared? There's not a whole lot. I think there's all these people that are just personally invested. They've been working, some of these people, 30 and 40 years of their lives on this case, knowing like they know that theory A is what happened, theory B is what happened. I can't tell you how many times I get phone calls or emails from people that say, well, we know it's not a theory. We know that this is the truth, and you have to accept this truth. And this is actually what happened. All the rest of it is just a bunch of BS, and it's not, it's all theory, and this is actually truth. I get those emails 4 or 5 times a week. And so, it's been like that for years. So I think people are just so invested in this thing personally, emotionally, mentally, financially, that imagine having to come out and tell everybody the last 40 years of your life was not a lie, but you were wrong. Imagine working the Nicomororo, the Castaway theory, and imagine that Bill Snavely pulls a plane out of the water at Buka, and 40 years of your life, we were wrong. That's not an easy pill to swallow. Imagine, Japanese capture being the one that's correct, and everybody else has to sort of concede to that. And sometimes I wonder if it runs so deep that maybe there'll never be any conceding. Even if the plane is pulled out of the water and off the shores of Howland, 18,000 feet down tomorrow, they're going to say the plane was planted there. Or if we get DNA somehow, somewhere, they're going to say, oh, that's, you got the bodies, but where's the plane? The plane is what we really, it's just round and round we go. So I think people are so invested in this particular story. And the fact that she really was America's sweetheart, everybody wants to sort of find out what happened to her. That is sort of cause for all of the investment and really just the bitterness and the anger and the pain and just that surrounds this story. And it's really just, if you're kind of looking at it like at a 10,000 foot view, you don't really see that. But when you start doing research, you start looking at all these different theories, and you start looking into some of these forums, and you start listening to the feedback and things, it's stunningly and almost embarrassingly apparent that there is just a lot of anger and a lot of bitterness in this case. And it's really quite sad, really, to be honest with you. I don't think if Earhart was here, she would endorse that. Not at all.
In your experience talking with these people, do you think that the emotional aspect to it gets in the way at all of the academic aspect?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I'd say without a doubt it does. I think confirmation bias runs rampant through this case. I think people's personal thoughts and emotions and personal opinions on this case sort of trump some of the evidence sometimes. I think it's one of those situations where you can have an idea and it's your own original idea, and you can become so obsessed with that idea that if facts come out that disprove it, you discard those facts. And I think that happens all the time. Happens not only in this case, but other cases as well. But it's one of those situations where, with this one, 82 years of data and research, I think emotions get in the way of it. People get so wrapped up in standing in opposite corners and pointing fingers at everybody else and trying to explain how everybody else is wrong and they're right that nobody really cares about trying to pull the data and trying to figure out, well, let's see really who's right here. Let's see if maybe it's a combination of things. So, yeah, the emotion, the anger, the pain, the bitterness, it trumps a lot of that stuff. It gets in the way, and it kind of tramples sometimes just the research itself, which should stay pure. And a lot of people, I think if you ask everybody in our group, if you ask people that have been researching this previously, they'll say the research is the most important thing. We need to make sure that the research stays pure, it doesn't get tainted. That's long gone at this point. The research is tainted. The research is no longer pure. This is a dirty case now at this point. And it's dirty with the opinions and the emotions and the raw anger and bitterness and all that stuff that just surrounds everything, you know, the nucleus of what's important, which is that research. So yeah, absolutely. It's definitely there. It's ever present. And I don't know that it's ever going to leave, even if the plane's found, even if DNA is found.
I mean, we talked a lot on Vanished about, you know, what it takes to be an expert. You know, we talked about things like peer review. We talked about things like you said, like confirmation bias. But from what I'm seeing, based on what you're telling me right now, and just from my experience working with you on Vanished, is if someone's going to come talk to us and they're going to come advocate for a certain position, they're an Earhart researcher, they've been doing this for many years, but not one single person that came forward is somebody that says, I am an unbiased, I don't have an opinion, but this is the research that I have done and I want to share it with you. That didn't happen. Every single person I talked to came from one of these. Well, I, you know, used to work with Tiger, or I subscribe to Japanese Capture. Like, they were very open about that. They were like, this is what I think, and I'm going to tell you why I think that. I don't think, and maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong, is there anyone out there that's actually academically doing this research, trying to gather data, trying to answer questions, trying to do this kind of thing that doesn't, as of right now, have an opinion about what happened? Or is it all just 5, 6, 8 different camps and you have to try and sort through what they're trying to push to you?
I think there are people out there that will subscribe to a theory or an idea, but are more than willing to be swayed toward another idea if the work and the data walks that way. I think there are a handful of people, it's not very big, but I think there are a handful of people that are of that mind. I don't think you'll find anyone that will come in and say, I have no opinion on this case, but this is where the data leads. Now, maybe at the very outset, at the beginning, when someone comes in and says, you know, this, let's say they're coming in from left field and they're just really, they were brought in maybe by somebody else, there's already a certain amount of sort of taint there. Because if, let's say, I am working on a particular theory, let's say I'm working Japanese Capture and I bring in a specific expert. Well, that expert I'm bringing in for a reason, because I want that expert to sort of validate the work that I'm doing and validate the ideas that I'm giving. And that's happened also a lot in this case, where people, this happened with Tiger and the patch panel. A good, great example of that is they sent that patch panel when they first found it, they sent it to Elgin Long, who is one of the pioneers for Crash and Sync, and said, hey, we think this is the patch panel off for L10E. He said, no, it's not. We had it looked at by a panel of our own people. It's not hers. And instead of saying, well, okay, we had them look at it and they're saying it's not hers, they said, well, no, you guys are wrong. It really is hers. So what was the point of doing that in the first place? That's sort of the level that you're dealing with here. It's people will bring in experts to look at stuff. And if those experts don't fall into line and sort of drink the same Kool-Aid, then those experts aren't as relevant to that theory as maybe that person initially hoped. There are independent researchers. We have them in the group that have been very great at researching sort of all different aspects of the case and all different aspects of various theories. And they're kind of talking about how these certain areas are fascinating and they want to get it looked at all the way till the end and things like that. So they exist, they're out there, but it's not as many as you might think. It's a very small percentage of the Earhart research population, if any. But I do know that on the flip side of that, there are a handful of people that, hey, I am, you know, a Japanese Capture subscriber. I do believe that, but I am very willing to be open to these other ideas. Dr. Tom King's a great example of that. He had been working with Tiger for many, many, many years and is no longer with them now. But what you get with Dr. Tom King is you get an honest look at all the different theories, an honest look at data. So if you have a paper you've written, if you have something you need him to look at, he'll look at it. And if he thinks it's got merit, he'll blatantly tell you that he thinks it's got merit. And I think it's not just words. I think it's actions. It's on his blog and it's on different aspects. I mean, he believes that, you know, certain other theories are very plausible. He still believes that Castaway is the most probable, but he's open to that. And I think you've got probably a dozen or so others that are of the same mind. But as far as someone that's just going to stick with it purely and stay pure, I don't know that that exists.
So, and when you say the group, you mean the Facebook group?
Right. Facebook group. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is going to happen then if we find a plane and we are able to positively identify it as hers? Either we find a serial number or we find DNA or something happens that's going to be really, really hard to refute that either the plane or her or him is in this location at this spot. Do you think that it's ever, like, are people going to be satisfied with that? Is it going to be, okay, mystery solved, story over?
Probably not. To be honest with you, probably not. And that's sort of sad for me to say that. I think if they pull the plane out of the water off the shores of Howland tomorrow, I think you're going to have people that are going to rejoice and are going to be very happy about that. And a large amount of people will accept that. Hey, okay, she crashed, she sank, that's it. Let's focus on the legacy, which I've been trying to get people to do for a very long time. I think you're going to find people that are going to say, where are the bodies then? You know, I think if you find DNA on one of the other many places, let's say they identify the plane at Buka as being hers, I think you're going to have a massive can of worms if that happens. I've talked to Bill Snavely privately on many occasions, and I told him, I said, it's not over when you find that plane and identify that plane. I said, it's just beginning. It's just going to begin for you at that point. Because at that point, you're going to have to tell the story of how she got there. You hypothesize it, but now you have to figure it out for real, for sure, because you're changing history at that point. I just talked to Guy Nofsinger and his team, just interviewed them for Chasing Earhart, the last theory episode of Chasing Earhart we're going to put out in next week or the week after, whatever it's going to end up being. And they have a very fascinating story. It's right out of a movie. It ties the lost Clipper, the Hawaii Clipper, into Amelia Earhart. Long story short, the Clipper was outfitted with a crew and $3 million of money to go and trade for Amelia Earhart at the time. And that Clipper vanished as well. And that is a really fascinating story. If they can find the link to that Clipper, that might link to Earhart. And that's a really incredible piece. But how are they going to prove all that? That's really, really interesting, really exciting. But it's a lot. It's a tall order. I think even they know that. And I really don't know if it turns out that Irene Bolam was Amelia Earhart, or to go one step further, if it turns out that Irene Bolam was in a very small inner circle that knew actually what happened to Amelia Earhart, that could also change things forever. And then you're also going to have to open up a whole other chapter in this case. So if they find the plane, I think for the most part, the general public will probably go along with it. People that don't really have an iron in the fire, they just say, oh, they finally found her. Wow, that's pretty amazing. And they can do something really special with it, perhaps like they did with the Titanic and things like that. But I think the hardcores, the people that are in the Earhart community, it's not going to solve anything for them. It's just going to open up another chapter. And it's just going to be another situation of round and round we go. And I think it's really quite shameful at that point, because at a certain point you have to put this to bed. And if somebody finds a plane or somebody finds DNA, it's over. There's no well, maybe this might have happened and maybe this might have happened, and it's over, it's dead. You know, let her rest, let him rest, let the legacy stand at that point and leave the mystery behind. But I think the mystery is too, unfortunately, too fruitful for too many people. It's too big of a moneymaker for too many people. And it's just one of those things that there's a lot of great interest for a multitude of reasons in keeping that mystery alive.
What do you have to say to some of the people that criticize you for giving a platform to multiple different theories? And I know more than one person has said that to you, that,
oh, yeah,
well, I'm not going to come on this show because you gave a platform to Tiger, or I'm not going to come on this show because you gave a platform to Japanese Capture. What do you have to say to those people?
I'm really, really just so tired of hearing that, to be honest with you. It's, and you've experienced it a little bit in with Vanished and people that would agree to come on the show at first. And when they hear that you're going to cross-examine them, it's crickets. They don't want to, they don't respond to our emails anymore, or they don't, when they understand what the format really is, they don't come back. We never hear from them. I am just so tired of people saying, you know, hey, I'm not going to come on the show because you give credence to sham theories. Well, I got to tell you, again, I get that email and that response 4 or 5 times a week. And guess what? It's funny that you say that, because every other theory says that about you. So I just feel like that's a cop-out excuse. I feel like if you really truly believe in what you believe, you'll have no problem coming on the show and talking with our team, being interviewed by me, being cross-examined by you. You'll have no problem with that because you believe so much in what you're doing that it's just like second nature for you. And so when you have these names, big names in the Earhart community that say they're going to come on the show and just sort of cop out after that because they don't want to be cross-examined, because they don't want to be made to be potentially look bad. Well, that's really not a question for us. That's really not on us. That's really on you. And I can't tell you how many times in Vanished, and you know this as well as I do, that we'll do a show and we'll have somebody on there and they'll be like, hey, why didn't Jen cross-examine that person? Well, it's because they refused to be cross-examined, or they never returned our emails after that. You know, you sort of have to shrug your shoulders at that point and just, we did what we could do. You know, it sort of is what it is. So there are, that sort of leads to some regrets. I would have loved to see you cross-examine specific people on the show that just never materialized for us. But people don't realize that behind the scenes, we're reaching out to these people, we're asking them, you're contacting them personally multiple times, and they're just not responding to you. And this happens cross theory, almost every theory episode we've done. And the excuse, if we ever get a hold of those people, is, well, we don't want to come on the show because we're researching it scientifically, and everything we're doing is based on fact, and everything everybody else is doing is just based on conjecture and theory and just all this other stuff. And it's like, yeah, everybody says that. You got to come.
Doesn't that, you know, when you say I'm doing this academically, what I'm doing is based on the facts and on the data and everything else. Isn't that part of it? Isn't, when you put out an academic paper, for example, you put it out there to be peer reviewed. You are inviting others to criticize your work and to challenge you on it. And isn't this the exact same thing?
Absolutely.
For us asking people, hey, you have put a lot of work into this. You have done so much academic work. I want you to come on the show and be asked tough questions by somebody that is trying to do their best to prove that you are wrong. Isn't that part of the academic spirit?
Absolutely.
So when they say they don't, so then when they say, I don't want to be asked tough questions, of course they're not, nobody's admitting that. Nobody's coming out and saying, I don't want to be asked the tough questions. What they're doing is they're saying, you know, I don't want to be on a show that gives platforms to more than one theory. But to me, those two things are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody says that, is that just another example of their confirmation bias? Does it show you that they're not academic, or is it just because they're nervous? Like, what, how do you feel whenever somebody actually says that? How do you feel about the theory when someone says that?
I lose a little bit of credence in the theory every time I hear that. I really do. And it happens a lot. Like I said, it happens all the time. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's the whole point of academia is to put something out. You hypothesize something's a certain way, and you put out your ideas and your theory, and it's up for what's known as peer review, which everybody's probably heard that term on, especially on this show at this point. Everybody's heard that term. Well, this is sort of, we're not peers of them, But we are sort of the only, well, we are the only people in the Earhart community that are doing it like we're doing it. You know, we're the only ones that are actually talking to everybody. And I think that's sort of the point when people ask me, well, who are you guys working with? And I always tell them, well, everyone. That's sort of the point of the project. That's always been the point of the project, is you work with everybody. There are people that can simply cannot handle that. And it's very difficult for me because I am in arguably the most unique position in the entirety of the Earhart case and community because of the position I take. And I've been called everything from a coward to, you know, you name it. I mean, everything you can think of, because I don't pick a theory and I don't subscribe to a theory. And I think I've told this to my wife many times, the only thing worse in this case than picking a theory and swearing to that theory is not picking a theory at all and trying to remain neutral, because you're getting crucified from four different directions. Because if you're working on one specific theory, you got four other ones that are trying to stick knives in you the whole time and just talk about how terrible that theory is. And why are you giving these people that platform? Why didn't you question them on this? Trying to basically tell you how to run your own show that you're paying for, that you're investing all your time, money, blood, sweat, and tears into. And it's very frustrating when they use stuff like that as cop-outs. And it frankly, it just makes me angry, because it makes me feel like you guys don't believe in the theory enough. Either you don't believe in the theory enough to come on and be cross-examined, or you are truly worried that we're going to hit you with questions that you don't know how to answer, and it's going to make you look bad. And has that not happened in the show? It truly has. You've hit certain people with certain questions that have really done some detrimental damage to certain aspects of certain theories. And that scares people. And I've actually had people on the show beforehand tell me to make sure that you go easy on them. I mean, that's no joke. I've had people to actually say that to me. And it's one of those situations where it's like, look, we're just putting out a show. You know, we're having a friendly conversation, but we are going to ask you tough questions. And I think when people hear the term cross-examination, it weirds them out a little bit, because now it's not just someone that's going to buy everything they're saying. We're not just going to be yes men, yes women. We're going to be, oh, well, what about this? And you mentioned this, but that doesn't make sense. Can you explain that to me? And they're just not prepared for that. And so this show, once we converted to the trial by jury aspect of it, it really sort of changed the dynamic of the show. And it sort of changed the dynamic of how we're perceived, which is that people are a little worried about coming on our show, and maybe perhaps for good reason at this point.
I want to kind of switch gears a little and talk to you about the phrase conspiracy theory. And it kind of goes along the same vein, because all of the other theories accuse all of the other theories, or at least most of the other theories, from being conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. I think Crash and Sink is probably the only one that I haven't been heard called a conspiracy theory. Literally everything else,
yeah,
that's a conspiracy theory. And of course, that phrase has a lot of negative connotations to it. What do you think about people using that? Do you think any of these are true? Like, honestly, do you honestly think that any of these can be called conspiracy theories? And if so, what do you think about labeling them that?
I'm not really, really comfortable with labeling a conspiracy theory. I never have been. I think if you look at, you know, Brian Dunning actually had said it really well on the show when he was on, what was it, part 10, I think, of the show for Crash and Sink, and you were talking to him about it. He actually referred to like Buka and Castaway as just sort of like alternate histories, like alternate theories. And then he sort of referred to Japanese Capture and Irene Bolam, of course, as more conspiratorial, you know, conspiracy theories. And I've never been comfortable with that word. And the reason why I feel that way is because if Japanese Capture was truly the truth, if that's really what happened, then it's not a conspiracy. It's just history. And it's just history that just hasn't been told the right way. If she was really a spy, yeah, you know, it's not really a conspiracy theory, because she was a spy and people knew about it. And that was the way it was planned.
But there's government cover-up aspects. You know, yeah. Ask anyone in Japanese Capture, the government is trying to hide things from us. Does that not make it a conspiracy theory?
Well, to me, it talks about you know, when we talk about the cover-up aspects of it, I guess maybe I just have a sort of a bias toward the word conspiracy theory itself. I don't know why I've never really liked that word. So maybe I'm showing my bias on that a little bit. You know, I don't feel like, yeah, if a government cover-up is part of, if it's part of the plan, you know, or if it's a part of the idea that, hey, there really is a, you know, there really are Earhart papers in, you know, in the possession of the U.S. government, like Les Kinney states there are. And I think if you can, at the end of the show, I think that's one thing that you'll probably be able to agree on, that the government does have an Earhart file of some kind. What's in it? Who knows? It might be the most boring file you'll ever read in your life, but the file exists. And I think that the fact that the government might be covering up stuff, it's very possible, but just that conspiracy theory term, I just personally, I don't like it. I really couldn't flesh out why, to be honest with you. I don't like that term. I just think, you know, hey, if she was captured by the Japanese, or if she was a Japanese spy and she ended up getting captured and she ended up getting executed, or she ended up getting repatriated, whatever you want to believe, then that's the story. That's the history. But as far as conspiracy theory is concerned, I just don't like that word. And I don't think that you could really apply that to any of these theories, to be honest with you. And that might be kind of a weird statement, but I just feel like, hey, it's whatever it's going to end up being, that's going to end up being the historical truth. And it's no longer going to be a conspiracy theory. It's going to be truth. So that's kind of how I look at it.
If one of them is proven to be true, if one of the theories is proven to be true, then necessarily several of the other ones are going to be proven to be false. At that point, would you call it a conspiracy theory?
No. I just wouldn't. I would just think one of these people's going to get the "I told you so" moment. You know, Scott and Forrest actually coined that. I kind of stole that from them, but they're dead on. Somebody's going to get an "I told you so" moment. And it's very possible that it could be a couple of people that get it. It could be a possibility that a couple of these theories sort of intertwine to be the actual truth, to make up the truth. You know, let's say for a moment that Irene Bolam and Amelia and Japanese capture are both true. What I like about the Irene Bolam piece and the Japanese capture piece, and I don't know why it's so separated to the point where the folks that are working Japanese capture just think the Irene Bolam thing is just absolutely nuts and ridiculous. And they very well could be right. I'm not saying that it is or that it isn't. But do you remember those choose your own adventure stories that we used to read when we were kids?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, so that's really what this is in my eyes. What you've got here is you've got the idea that Amelia Earhart was either a spy, turn to page 12, she's a spy, turn to page 21, she's not a spy, you know, however you want to do it. Amelia Earhart was spying for the U.S. at the Marshall Islands. She was trying to take photos, whatever the case, or she was just flying to the Marshall Islands, got shot down, you know, however you want to look at it. The only difference between Japanese capture and Irene Bolam is one, she lives, and one, she dies. And the only difference there is that she stays on that island and either gets executed and kicked into a hole. It's a terrible, terrible fate. Or she dies of dysentery alone in a Garapan prison in a jail cell, which is also a terrible fate. But there's also a possibility that Amelia Earhart was repatriated. Now, do we know? We don't. But my point is, that's the only difference. The difference is that she came back. She was always captured. If that's the case, if you're going to roll with that, she always was captured by the Japanese. That's always part of the story. The only difference here was, well, did she successfully get returned? And I think when we talk about Irene Bolam and we talk about all that aspects of it, it's not something that you can say it's so far-fetched that it's not physically possible. And then at the same time, expect everybody to believe that, well, she was captured by the Japanese and she was a spy and all of this and that. It's like you can only accept 2/3 of the story, but you can't accept the potential ending of the story. And so for me personally, I think that with those particular two, they're sort of linked and they can go either way. And so, you know, who knows really at the end of the day? We don't. And that's sort of what I've been getting at this whole time. We don't know. And the one statement there is we don't know what we don't know. Who knows what's actually going to be uncovered in the next 365 days? We have no idea. I think I'm optimistic about what could potentially be uncovered and these varying theories, but we don't know. We have no clue. And anybody that tells you they do know that there's only one universal truth, I'm sorry, it's just not right.
And you don't have to tell me what it is, but do you have an idea in your head of what you think happened?
Truthfully, I have no idea what happened. And that's one thing that I feel 100% comfortable in saying, because I've also been accused of being a cop-out and a coward and things like that for not picking a theory. Truthfully, I don't know. I have no idea. I think any one of these theories could be correct at this point. I think if you look at Crash and Sync, and you and I have talked a lot about this, and you've actually educated me a lot about this when it comes to the, just like a modern day jury trial case, how would this look? The Itasca logs are the final messages, the final text messages. We have no body. But you do have Leo Bellarts, which is really the closest actual eyewitness, historically based eyewitness in this particular case. And you've got, you know, the voice of AE saying she was right there at Howland. So you've got that. That's really extremely compelling. Anybody that brings anything to the table that's going to have to really overthrow that in a major way with a massive piece of evidence. I think you and I have talked about that a lot. And so you've got that, but you've also got Japanese capture with all those eyewitnesses. That was one of the first questions I ever asked you. Well, I talked to you about eyewitnesses and said, well, what if there's like 200 of them? Well, does that change the game? What happens there? And I remember us talking about that on part 7 when you were first introduced to the show. That's a major compelling thing. All this government cover-up stuff, all of this idea that that Earhart and Noonan were potential spies, that's very compelling. And all the different little sub-theories that kind of fall in between that. I think the Lost Clipper with Guy Nofsinger and things kind of falls into the Japanese capture aspects of it. I mean, it's a different thread, but it's kind of under that umbrella. The Irene Bolam stuff is just weird. Something was wrong with that woman. Something was up with that woman. And I would love to find out what it was. And, you know, you have Buka. They've got a plane, for God's sake. They've determined that plane is not a military plane. It's a twin-tail, twin-engine plane. The length of the plane, the width of the plane, everything matches. All the stuff that they've been talking about over the years on that plane that has been reported to have been seen inside that plane before the terrible coral coverage that's basically kind of ghosted that plane now, kind of took over. You've got all these really fantastic theories and these fantastic ideas. And so I can't pick one or the other because it's something changes all the time. And it's, I think it was Scott or Forrest, that said, it's like those people that test new cars. Like, you know, they get these new cars. It's like, oh, this is the best car ever. It's got everything on it. And then they test it and they get the next car. And it's like, oh, this is the best car ever. It's got everything on it. And it just keeps going. It's like you can look at any one of these theories in and of themselves, and you can be convinced of that theory if you're not educated on the case, if you're just looking at it as a bystander. And that's sort of the whole premise of Vanished. You know, if you're sitting on a jury, what convinces you? All of these people have all this different data and these different types of evidence to support their theory. What convinces you? I'm truly not convinced yet on any of them. And that's why I sleep fine at night. People call me things all the time. I get accused of things. I get phone calls. I get emails all the time. I sleep just fine. I truly don't know what happened, but I am optimistic that hopefully in the next year with all these active investigations, we will have an answer and I will be genuinely happy to congratulate whoever finds it, whoever finishes this case, puts it to bed. Because as we've always said, the legacy is what's the most important thing here. And I think the legacy is sort of overshadowed by the disappearance. And we've been really been working on trying to not allow that to happen. But the two are forever intertwined until we find out the answer.
Did Vanish accomplish what you hoped it would accomplish?
It did, I think. I started that show because I wanted to sort of affect change in some way, shape, or form. And that's why we sort of did the show in the manner in which we did it. The first 7 episodes were important, just as important as everything we've done, you and I have done together, because it sets a tone. It tells a story. You can't know why everybody cares so much until you know why this woman was so important and who this woman was and who this man was. you can't know that. You can't understand fully. And so I set out to do sort of this guerrilla style handheld recorder narrative thing that I did for the first 7 episodes. And I remember as we get closer to episode 6, I knew we had to do something different with the case. And I had been thinking about it for quite some time. And I thought, if we did this as a jury trial case, how would this feel? How would this come across? You know, it's never been done like that before. If this was a modern day jury and all these people got to sit on a stand and get cross-examined by attorneys and things and a jury of their peers and the whole nine, how would that feel? You know, how would that work? And so I credit you because that's why I reached out to you. And I think we were successfully able to pull it off. I remember the early conversations and I just remember asking you and hoping you weren't thinking that I was crazy. But I remember asking you, I'm sure, yeah, well, 100%. There you go. But I remember asking you, like, can I do this? Is this even a doable thing? Because if it wasn't, then we're sort of screwed at the outset, right? So I was really sort of leaning on you to say, yes, absolutely, it's doable, and this is how we would do it. And to your credit, you were able to figure out a way to make it doable and to make it sound good. And I think the feedback from the listeners, I think the how the show has grown and how the show got more popular as we started doing the theory episodes and we started getting more listeners and we got the group formed and the group has been phenomenal. It's been really there's been a lot of buzz in the group. People are discussing things, they're sharing ideas now, they're talking back and forth. I think considering all of that, I think it was a success. And I think I feel comfortable walking away now from the Earhart case forever after 15 years of my life working on this case research-wise. And that's really nothing compared to some of the other people. But for me, I never wanted this to be my lifelong thing. I wanted to move on to other cases, other things, which we're going to be doing, of course. But it's time for me to exit. It's time for me to sort of let all this go. And I think Vanished accomplished what it set out to accomplish. And I'm very proud of it. And I would love to go back on it someday and listen to it from part one all the way through, you know, the end of the show. Maybe give it a few years and just listen to it and just think about it. Well, I feel the same way, you know, a few, 3 or 4 years from now, maybe. I don't know about that. But as of right now, I feel 100% confident in saying that I think it accomplished what it set out to accomplish. And then some.
Well, I did and do think you are crazy, but I'm really happy that you contacted me. This has been a lot of fun, and I learned a lot, and I got to meet a lot of really cool people. Some of them also think they're crazy, but I love them anyway. It's been a lot of fun. Is there anything that you want to tell everybody that I didn't ask you about? Maybe something I missed?
No, I mean, I think the only thing I'd want to say is I want to thank everybody for tagging along with us. And I really do. I think that's, you know, we did 80 episodes of Chasing Earhart. We just released episode 78. We got a couple more left. And we did actually more than 80 because we did bonus episodes and stuff throughout that process. We did that panel back a couple years ago that was really extraordinary. We did 16. It'll be 16 episodes of Vanished Amelia Earhart. So it'll be, you know, with all the bonuses, a little over 100 episodes dedicated to one case. And I think that's really something we should be proud of. I think I'm very proud of it. I feel comfortable at this point walking away. And I just would want to thank all the people that ever listened to the show, that listened to something that somebody said and had an aha moment regarding Earhart or maybe even their own lives or something. And I think all I ever tried to do was just to interview people, be as straightforward as possible. Be as neutral as possible, because my goal was always for the data to get out and for not some idiot to try to overshadow, the guest that was on the show by trying to be, you know, something that he's not. I've just, at the end of the day, I'm just an interviewer. I'm just a guy that just kind of like was really fascinated about the case. And I still love hearing stories about Earhart, still love listening to people talk about it. And I'll always be fascinated with the case. I'll always follow it. And, you know, they have multiple specials coming out. We have something in the works. I have a couple of things that are in the works. But as far as walking away from the case and sort of the active investigations into the Earhart case and interviewing all these people and staying up with it, I'm ready to go. and ready to wrap it up. And I just thank everybody that ever listened to the show. And I'm sure that you would join me in that. I mean, it's been a real hell of a run, and it's been a lot of fun with you, and it's been a lot of fun doing both shows. And now it's time for us to take a well-deserved break and put Earhart to bed for a little while.